Hello and welcome to another bonus episode from the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, science journalist Izzy Clark, astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst and the Society's deputy director, Dr. Robert Massey. So before we dive into everyone's questions, I think we've had some really lovely messages from listeners this month. Becky, can you read out this next one?
Sure. Okay, so this one's from Andrew Street, who writes, "Dear Supermassive folks." Which I enjoy that. "Very late to the party, I know, but I only recently discovered the podcast and I've been busily devouring the catalogue. Like Becky, I am borderline obsessed with Saturn and wanted to share this link with you. Because I am insanely fortunate, I was one of the handful of people invited to the Deep Space Network site at Tidbinbilla, I'm gonna guess. Tidbinbilla, near Canberra.
I would say that.
"Invited to the Deep Space Network site at Tidbinbilla near Canberra back in September 2017 for the final transmission from Cassini. And as was discussed on your episode, it was indeed a deeply emotional experience, so much so that I wrote a piece about it for The Guardian," and that's the link that Andrew has sent. "It's still one of the most glorious and moving experiences of my life, and yes, I still have that packet of unopened Cassini tissues. Keep up the great work," which I originally wrote as stellar work, but then realised that was both too inadvertently punny and also occasionally accurate. Cheers, Andrew." Oh, thank you so much for that, Andrew. That was so lovely to read. And we'll be sure to link that Guardian article in the episode description for anyone who wants to read that.
Oh, such a lovely message. I really smiled when I got that one. And I'd like to award Michael Brill from the Australia Antarctic Division as our most remote listener, who has emailed from Antarctica with some amazing photos of the night sky. I'm going to put these on our Instagram. And the first photo was taken at Wilkins, the ice runaway servicing Casey Station in Antarctica. And it was taken during the setup stage of the runway mid-September. And the second photo was his last night at Morse Station before heading home, which was taken a couple of years ago. And the skies,
I mean, they're just incredible that you sent. I already know the Southern Hemisphere skies put the Northern Hemisphere skies to shame, but I think being in Antarctica, you really get the full, you know, just like perspective on that. Like, you know, we usually see the center of the Milky Way fairly low down here, but in this picture he sent, it's just like
I'm here
like arching out overhead, and it's just, you know, you can see the color of all the individual stars. You know, when we talk about blue stars and red stars, like blue stars being hotter, red stars being colder, it just pops up in such amazing clarity in this image where, you know, there's probably so little light pollution, so little air pollution, no humidity or anything. It's just incredible. Oh. You know, if the Greenwich Astronomy Photographer of the Year is paying attention. Yeah. But then the second image he sent is also just as spectacular, because it's the Aurora Australis that he's captured, the southern lights, this incredible green glow, which usually, I mean, I've seen it before in Iceland where you just see this, like, you know, maybe one or two ribbons. Mm. But I mean, what he captured was just incredible. It's like the entire sky is green. So if you get a chance to go on our Instagram or our Twitter and see these images, do, because they really are absolutely spectacular.
Yeah, thank you so much for sending those in, Michael.
Also, I love, who gave you like the authority to start awarding awards? Like, you were like, I am going to award. It's because that's something I could do and Robert could do.
Sorry,
now.
No, I'm going to play the producer card as well, and therefore it is me. Hello. Okay, so let's go on to some questions. Robert, Amelia has this question about telescopes. What is the furthest distance away we've ever observed with a telescope, and how can we improve telescopes in the future? I love the podcast and really want to be an astrophysicist when I'm older.
Oh, yeah, you go, Amelia.
Yeah, you can do it.
Exactly. Great to hear from you, Amelia. And yes, and good luck with that. We really want you to be an astrophysicist as well. The answer is we sort of can see as far as we can now. And the reason is that when you look at very, very distant things, you're looking back in time and you get to a point where you reach the age of the universe. So the fundamental limit is you can't see anything before the Big Bang, when the light can't have traveled more than 13.8 billion years. However, there are complications around that. So firstly, I was thinking about this and I thought, well, actually, the most distant stuff we detect is what's called the cosmic microwave background, the kind of residual heat of the Big Bang. And that is sort of from originating more than, well, 13.6 billion years ago, and it's about 40 billion light years to that now. And then if you think about things instead, you're probably thinking of things like galaxies and stars and so on. The most distant one we found so far is with the James Webb Space Telescope, probably predictably, because that's what it was designed to do, to look at these very, very distant objects and that are, we're seeing them as they are very early in the universe. And the galaxy referred to, which like many of them isn't going to have a particularly exciting name, this one is called Jade's GSZ13-0, and it's so far away that its light's taken us 13.6 billion years, so 13,600 million years to reach us. So we're seeing it very early after the Big Bang. How long after depends on exactly which model you have of the universe, but then arguments about how fast it's expanding. But the because of the expansion of the universe, because the universe has got much bigger since then, that same galaxy would now be 34 billion light years away. So that's a really very long way away. Now, your other part of your question about how can we improve telescopes in the future, the general advice of telescopes is that predictably astronomers just want them to be bigger. And the reason we want them to be bigger is because they gather more light. They make the fundamental thing about a telescope is to get lots of light and concentrate it into a detector. So the more light, the better. The bigger the telescope gathering, the better. And also build more sensitive detectors. But we're kind of there with detectors and how much light we can get. You can't really get much more into them. So it's about building bigger telescopes. And the one to look out for in 2028, 5 years' time, it was the European extremely large telescope. I don't know what they'll have after that. You know, I think we've talked about this before, the overwhelmingly large telescope, the stupendously large telescope. But anyway, this is being built in Chile. It'll have a mirror 39 meters across. Just think about that. Absolutely enormous, you know, bigger than most houses.
If you look at like the building that they're like halfway through construction, and the building looks like a stadium to house this thing. It's huge.
It's crazy. This thing is steerable, you know, and it'll be big enough to see Earth-like planets around the nearest stars. So that's one of the reasons we're quite excited about it. And there are also plans to put more telescopes in space as well to be successors to James Webb and to Hubble. The Louvois one might launch in around 2039 or so. So I was thinking about this. I'll be quite old by then, but still around to enjoy the
The ELT, the stat I've heard is that it will give us better resolution than Hubble, but from the ground, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah. And Becky, Joe has emailed to ask, Mars lost its atmosphere from solar winds because it has no magnetic field, but Venus also doesn't have a magnetic field. But why hasn't Venus lost its atmosphere from solar winds?
Well, that's a great question, Joe, and you've stumbled on a very large debate there. Well done. So first of all, Venus is losing its atmosphere at about the same rate that Mars is. Earth is also doing the same. And it's all sort of a balance between sort of like molecules having enough energy to escape the, like molecules in the atmosphere having enough energy so they're traveling fast enough to escape the gravitational pull of that planet, right? And so the one thing you have to remember is that Venus is almost 8 times heavier than Mars. So even though, yes, it is too blasted by the solar wind and all the radiation from the sun, it can hold on to its molecules in its atmosphere that much better, which, you know, hang on, where am I going here? Sorry, this is so small, these notes. So it can't. So even though that Venus is also being blasted by the solar wind and obviously at much stronger concentrations because it's that much closer to the sun, it can hold on to its atmosphere that much better. And its atmosphere is 92 times thicker than Earth's. So it's a very dense atmosphere as well. But there is a lot of debate about whether, you know, the solar wind and the lack of its magnetic field is the reason that Mars lost its atmosphere. Because, like I said, Earth is losing atmosphere at the same rate as Venus and Mars, roughly speaking. You know, like, you know, it's not exactly the same value, but between astronomers, it's roughly the same amount. And that has a magnetic field. So there was a paper by Gunnell and collaborators from 2018 who found that sort of atmospheric loss rates are independent of whether a planet has a magnetic field or not. And actually sometimes magnetic fields can speed up that loss rate because you can escape through the poles because there's, you know, sort of not as much protection there. And so instead you have to take everything into account for a planet. So its mass, its size, its atmospheric composition, its magnetic field, its gravitational pull, everything. And that, you know, has really important knock-on effects as we start to search for candidate habitable exoplanets as well. Because, you know, we think of habitability as, you know, if it has a magnetic field, it's going to be more habitable. But is that not necessarily the case then? Do you not have to have a magnetic field to hold on to, you know, a denser atmosphere, for example? So it is a big debate that's currently sort of ongoing. it is the leading idea for why Mars lost its atmosphere, and also because it is a lot smaller. You know, it is like half the size of Earth, so it can't hold on to it as easily. So the solar wind could have a bigger effect. But there's probably a lot of things at play there. It's still an open area of investigation.
Ah, well, good question, Joe. And Robert, Teresa Arispe has this question on Plunets. That's PLOONETS.
Plunets.
Okay, so recent research has suggested the idea of Plunets, former large moons of giant planets that become planets in their own right when something happens to gravitationally tear them away from their host planet, so they are instead directly orbiting a star. Given our own Mercury's strange properties, such as its large core in proportion to its mantle and its unusually elliptical orbit, is it possible that Mercury could be a plunet? Perhaps one that once had a thick ice shell, such as the Galilean satellites. Could it be a lost moon of Jupiter or Saturn as a result of early planetary migration, or maybe even a moon of the hypothetical planet 5 required in migration models?
Oh, someone's been doing some reading.
Yeah, someone's done some reading. Right, over to you, Robert.
A lot of good questions there. I hadn't come across the term plunets before, and I thought, oh, this is fun. And it was described as a term, but there's a journalist, Amanda Kuser, one of the people who's written about this, said, oh, it was charmingly goofy, and I tend to agree.
Because you have to say it, plunets.
And it was invented. Plunets, yeah. So, but invented by a team led by a Colombian astronomer, Mario Sequeira, in 2019. And when we actually published it in our journal, Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, so I should really have known about this. But they're hypothetical exomoons, so moons from planets that are in orbit around other stars that have escaped their host planets. And that might happen. The idea is that if you have, say, one of these Jupiter-like planets in other solar systems that we see that have ended up close to their star as a hot Jupiter, the idea is they migrated inwards. And as they migrated inwards, they'd lost some of these worlds. And probably what happened, because they interact with the gravity of the other planets in the system as they move in, probably what happens is that a lot of these plunets end up crashing into the planet or the star in the center, but some of them might survive a lot longer, and they might be able to grab some of the material in the forming solar system and end up as planets. Now, we don't have, our solar system is either it's unusual, or it's just that we haven't seen many like it yet, and that's because the kind of telescopes we've got, what's the observational bias. We don't have a kind of hot Jupiter or even a hot Uranus in our solar system, so we haven't got quite that setup. So I don't think it would be that would explain Mercury. And as for Planet 5, and Planet 5 is this planet that might have existed between Mars and Jupiter before being ripped apart from the asteroid belt. If that existed and migrated or was torn apart or went into something, possibly is the answer, I think. The only thing I can think about this is that Mercury, although it's a small planet, it's still a reasonably decent size. So to have something that big, it's fairly unusual. There's only a few examples in our solar system of moons that are that big. So whether it would have been enough to form in that situation, I just don't know. But this is the kind of thing where we probably ought to, I don't know, do an episode or something on the origin of the solar system and talk to people who know about the dynamics of these things. But yeah, a great set of questions, Teresa. I'm sorry I can't answer it completely.
Sorry, I was literally just making a note to make episode on origin of solar system.
There we go.
Okay, Becky, Dan Kelly on Instagram has a question about the moon. He says, hello. So we're constantly on the lookout for space objects on a collision course with Earth, but nothing is ever said about objects hitting the moon. Have there been any objects colliding with the moon in our observable past? And how stable is the moon's orbit around the Earth? Would it ever be possible for something to strike the moon and change its orbit and send it flying away from Earth or into Earth itself? Let's end on a bit of existential crisis.
Yeah. So first of all, let's start with have there been any objects colliding with the moon in our observable past? Yes, many. Every single crater that you see on the moon is from an impact with, say, an asteroid or comet. So if you break out your binoculars or a telescope, when it's not a full moon, at least when you've got the shadow running down the moon, you can see loads and loads of craters, and you can see that the mare, Robert? Mare?
Take that.
Seas of, you know, French seas of tranquility, things like that, that are thought to be from these collisions with asteroids, you know, it would create lava that would then solidify into these seas as well. So all those features you can see on the moon are essentially, we think, from impacts with the moon. So the sort of Earth-Moon system and the inner solar, oh, So the Earth Moon system and the inner solar system as a whole really went through this period known as the late heavy bombardment, around about 4 billion years or so ago, where there was a higher number of collisions than usual that occurred. And we can really see that record on the moon. It really is a fossil of all of those. Now, as for things hitting the moon and knocking it out of its orbit, technically, with something big enough and traveling fast enough, you could impart enough energy to change the, you know, any object's orbit, you know, the moon included, no matter how stable its orbit was before that. You know, and that's what the DART mission has done when it collided with that asteroid. Do you remember? It collided with a Dimorphos in orbit around Didymus, and we managed to see that we've changed its orbit. And that was sort of this idea of, could we redirect an asteroid if it was necessary? But in the case of the moon, like if you were going to do this as an evil supervillain, like you would need a dwarf planet, essentially, to do this, right? You would need something like 500 kilometers and above, let's say, like in terms of like size of something that you would need to not to give to impart enough energy to the moon to counteract Earth's gravitational pull and to change it. And there's not really any of those dwarf planets knocking around these parts of the solar system, so it's not something you can really easily get your hands on to change the orbit of the moon. And the other thing is, even if there was a large asteroid on a collision course, you know, sort of with the moon at first, I mean, the Earth's gravitational pull is that much stronger than the moon, so it would likely pull it off course and it likely not hit the moon, it would likely hit Earth instead. So, you know, unless it was the late heavy bombardment, there's just so many of them coming in, you know, that was they were bound to hit the moon as well. So thankfully, I don't think, Dan, that this is very likely at all that this would happen. But as I said, theoretically, yes, this is possible.
I want to add one thing to this, actually. Well, two little things. One is that we've definitely also seen things hitting the moon.
Oh, yes.
Frequently, we see flashes on the moon's surface. And there was one back about 10 years ago when something the size of a car hit the moon and there was a bright flash. And the other thing I was thinking
10 years ago, so it wasn't the Tesla then.
It wasn't the Tesla, no. That's somewhere else. The surface. Maybe that's next on the list, yeah. The other thing I was thinking, actually, as you're talking about knocking the moon off orbit, I thought, you know, for those people who remember Space 1999 and the premise from that, you know, then isn't going to happen. That was the idea, you know, that's definitely 70s vintage science fiction series, you know, explosion on the moon's surface, knocking it off course. And as you absolutely rightly say, Becky, it's just not that easy.
Also, there was that recent film as well. Was it Moonfall, where the moon fell to Earth? I don't know if that was because of a collision or what, but like, yeah, that was also science fiction gibberish.
I didn't recommend that one in my choice.
No,
my choices.
I did not. I definitely didn't.
That has not made Space Content Club. Absolutely not. Okay, well, thanks everyone, and keep the questions coming. You can email podcast@ras.ac.uk, tweet @RoyalAstroSoc, and we're on Instagram @SupermassivePod.
And you should definitely send in those questions, because the next time we're back with an episode which is a dedicated Q&A episode. So start thinking now, get them sent in as soon as you can, because we want to try and answer as many of your questions, because they really are absolutely excellent, as we heard in this bonus question. You definitely test us, you do your reading, you come up with some fun ones.
I also really enjoy seeing Robert and Becky squirm when something crazy comes
every
up
time.
So, you know, it's really entertaining.
Yeah. So until me and Robert squirm again, and next time, happy stargazing, everyone.